When my son Linus was a teenager, he went to Quebec City with his aunt, uncle, and cousin. He had a good time, but one aspect of the trip puzzled him. "Mom, they just ate dinner wherever we ended up at dinner time. They didn't plan where they were going to eat." I understood what he meant. Our plans for the day would have started with where we were going to eat. I grew up in a food-centric home, the product of two foodie cultures. Jewish cooking is not considered one of the most refined, but we are known for the centrality of food in our celebrations and lives, and my family was no exception. And my parents were born and grew up in Belgium. A family friend once said that when two Belgians get together, it takes them at most 10 minutes before they start talking about food. My mother was an excellent cook, and as an only child, I spent a great deal of time in or near the kitchen with her. Being born in the mid-1950s, I was given classically gendered toys, which in addition to a large family of dolls, included dishes, pots and pans, and other child-sized cooking equipment. My mother painted a stovetop on a small bookshelf so I could pretend to cook just like she did. For my 7th or 8th birthday, I was given a set of miniature Revereware pots and pans that could be used on the real stove. My mother, of course, taught me to cook the kinds of things she liked to make, and I liked to look through her cookbooks, especially the Betty Crocker cookbook that had lots of photographs. Many of you may remember it. It was like a loose leaf binder with lots of photographs. The food looked a bit different from what we ate. It was real American food, some of which seemed rather exotic to me. Tuna casserole was not in my mother's repertory. As many of you know, I have a large cookbook collection, 378 at last count. I counted this week. Cookbooks represent the intersection of two of my passions, reading and cooking. It might have started with Betty Crocker, but it might also have begun with the Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder, which I started reading in 3rd grade. I loved them so much that I cried when I finished the last book and realized there were no more for me. I was fascinated by the fact that the Ingalls family made everything from scratch, and that was the beginning of my interest in preparing foods from their very beginnings. My parents, especially my mother, really only my mother, fed my interest in domestic history. We went to Sturbridge Village, Mount Vernon, and any restored house we could find, and were disappointed if the tour didn't include the kitchen. I couldn't do much practical experimenting at home. We had a tiny kitchen. Two thin people could stand in it. And any cooking over an open fire was done on a tiny hibachi on the shared concrete porch of our garden apartment in Queens. In any museum or old building, I go straight to the kitchen exhibits, whether it's the massive kitchen at the Prince Regent's Pavilion in Brighton, its walls lined with more pots, pans, colanders, and utensils than a Williams-Sonoma outlet, or the rudimentary cooking arrangements in a reconstructed apartment from the World War II Leningrad siege, which I just saw a couple of weeks ago. I want to know what people ate and how they prepared it. And like Marisa in the story Dumpling Soup, cooking connects me to my roots. Every year before Passover, I make Baba's macaroons. The recipe is in the order of service. Baba was my mother's grandmother, who died when my mother was a child in the 1920s. The basics of the recipe are simple and unchanging: the proportions of ground almonds to sugar to egg whites, and a bit of lemon juice. There have been adjustments over the years. My mother added the baking temperature and used hazelnuts as well as almonds. I bake mine on parchment paper instead of the sheets of brown paper from the Chinese laundry that my mother used. I've experimented with other nuts, pecans, and pistachios. I particularly like the pistachios because you get green macaroons. The vertical connection back to my great-grandmother extends horizontally as well. During the week before Passover, my cousins and I call each other, and we always ask, have you made Baba's macaroons yet? Are you trying anything new this year? I shared my nut variations and found out that my cousin Omi grinds up and adds a whole lemon instead of just using lemon juice. Now, Baba and both of my grandmothers kept strictly kosher kitchens. No pork or shellfish, meat salted and rinsed until no blood runs out. That's where kosher salt comes from. It's the salt that's used for koshering meat. No mixing of dairy and meat, including separate cooking and eating equipment for each. Seems an awful lot of trouble without much purpose. My paternal grandmother died in August 1961, and the first Passover following her death, when I was six, my grandfather came from Belgium to celebrate the holiday with us. We didn't keep kosher, so to prepare for my Orthodox grandfather's visit, my mother acquired four new sets of dishes and pots and pans. Regular meat and dairy, and Passover meat and dairy, because you can't mix those either, in that tiny kitchen. As a child, I just accepted what happened. Bon papa, that's the Belgian-French word for grandpa. Bon papa came and we got four new sets of kitchen equipment. But now I see it as an act of love and respect on my mother's part. And I think Bon papa understood that, even though it was never acknowledged that we weren't kosher before he came. An eccentric elderly cousin of my grandfather's, who was so Orthodox she wouldn't have more than a glass of water outside of her home, told Bon Papa, "The only place kosher enough for you to eat in New York is at my house." He answered, "The only place kosher enough for me is at my daughter-in-law's." Still, the whole kosher thing seemed silly to me. A huge network of rules around the basics of life, extrapolated from a couple of sentences in the Bible. But almost 30 years ago, I first read about eggs from factory farms and began buying only free-range eggs. I learned more and reconsidered the meat I bought. My friend Eve lived in the Poconos with her partner, Donna, a chiropractor who treated animals as well as people. So she was very sensitive to issues of animal welfare. Donna made friends with some farmers who raised animals as humanely as possible, and we began buying meat in bulk from them. I would drive out to a shopping mall in central New Jersey from Montclair. Eve would meet me there, and we would transfer the meat from coolers in her car to coolers in mine, in the parking lot behind the Borders bookstore, like a mafia drug handoff. My kids called it happy meat. I began to think of it as my way of keeping kosher. The 613 mitzvot, or commandments of Judaism, and keeping kosher is only a small part, govern every aspect of an observant Jew's religious and secular life. I was taught that the purpose is to remind us at all times of the presence of God in our lives. If there's a special way that you have to put on your clothes or a blessing you have to say when you get up in the morning, it will remind you always that God is there. Thinking about the lives of the animals who give us their milk, eggs, and flesh is a way of prodding us to think about the creatures who share the earth with us. whether it's reading the signs and labels in the store, buying humanely raised, organic, and local meat, vegetables, and fruits, or better yet, raising our own, can connect us with the sacredness of all life. Nowadays, we might call it eating mindfully and sustainably. And what is keeping kosher if not eating mindfully? This mindfulness extends beyond what we eat to how we prepare it. Some of the simplest tasks of cooking are my favorites. I love chopping vegetables. It becomes a meditative act, calming and centering me. And the transformations involved in cooking and baking are truly miraculous. For almost 35 years, with a few breaks and maternity leaves, I've made all of our family's bread. Still, I never stop marveling that starting with just flour, water, yeast, and salt, I can end up with something as wonderful as bread. It's a weekly miracle performed right in my own kitchen. Baking calms, soothes, and comforts me, which in these days is no small thing. In times of stress, you'll find me in the kitchen communing with dough. When we were moving from Oak Park to New Jersey, and I was stressed by packing, real estate, and small children, I baked obsessively. Every day, Barnaby went into his office with more treats. Finally, his colleagues said to him, "You can leave, but Michelle needs to stay here." I've shopped at the farmers markets in Madison, Wisconsin. The market there goes right around the Capitol building. Grand Army Plaza, Brooklyn, Oak Park, Illinois, Montclair, New Jersey, and of course here in Middlebury. When I travel, I visit markets. My most recent were La Merced Market in Mexico City, where I passed on the displays of edible insects and bought four different kinds of powdered mole. The Nash Market in Vienna, whose name has the same root as the Yiddish word nash, or snack. And the Harborside Market in Helsinki. Seeing the displays of the freshest fruits and vegetables, beautifully arranged breads, cheeses, pickles, and jams inspires more than greed in me, though that's definitely part of the experience. And of course, I learn about different cultures, that Mexicans eat insects, that there are honey producing beehives in the city of Vienna, and that the Finns make jam out of Arctic berries. But I also feel reverence for the fruits of the earth and the products of our hands. In order to be ever reminded of the presence of God, Judaism has a blessing for almost everything we do in the course of our daily lives. Those of you who have seen Fiddler on the Roof may remember there's one of the townspeople who asks the rabbi, "Rabbi, is there a blessing for the czar?" And the rabbi says, "Yes, may God bless and keep the czar far away from us." There's a blessing for everything. There are blessings for many kinds of food. Over wine, we say, "Blessed is God, the creator of the fruit of the vine." Over apples, "Blessed is God, the creator of the fruit of the tree." Over vegetables, "the fruit of the earth." But the blessing over bread, which is said at the beginning of every meal, is a bit different from all the other food blessings. It says, "Blessed is he who brings forth bread from the land." The "he" is actually implied, because you can do that in Hebrew, so it's nicely ungendered. But bread doesn't come forth from the land. It's not like fruit from the tree or vegetables from the earth. Bread doesn't come directly from nature. It requires human skill and imagination to come into being. It's a collaboration, as is wine. And those two foods, bread and wine, which come into being through the collaboration of the human and nature or the divine, are the foods that appear in many traditional rituals, like the Christian communion or the Jewish Sabbath. Maybe we need to bless more of our food as we plant it, harvest it, shop for it, prepare it, cook it, eat it, and share it. Here's my first draft of a blessing. Blessed is the food we eat, the sun and rain that nourished it, the plants and animals who provided it, the farmers who grew and raised it, the cooks who prepared it, and we who eat it in loving communion. Amen. And I'd like to finish with the grace that our kids made up when they were growing up that we said every night at dinner. Thanks for the food and another good day of love in the family.